Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our very special guest is Ella LeBain. Ella unravels some quintessential end times prophecies that dovetails into today's UFO disclosure era of the alien presence and how it's connected to these ancient galactic battles over Earth, while the passing of the Nemesis Nibiru system now intersects within our solar system, which will be presented through photos and videos from various NASA SOHO space telescopes, as well as the ISS. She will share her understanding of the real Star Wars that officially began during the Reagan administration when they launched the Strategic Defense Initiative dubbed Star Wars by the former President Reagan, which is detailed in her fifth book, The Heavens, along with connecting dots to the real Star Trek, America's real secret space program, proving truth is stranger than fiction. Ella connects dots to the historical clash of two kingdoms on Earth, evidence in the ancient Sumerian records as well as the historical biblical battles that have already taken place between various factions of alien races, while drawing on the great rejected Jewish scriptures that the Church of Rome deleted from today's biblical canon, which tells a much more detailed account of the Anunnaki and the Bible's fallen angel stories and where these survivors ended up. Ella will cover the question, why Jerusalem? Why Israel, and what is the connection between alien disclosure and Israel? Her first book on discerning the ETs and aliens begins with these questions and lays the foundation for paying attention to these suppressed Jewish prophecies that confirm the ancient Sumerian messages etched in stone. Her multimedia presentations reveal gigantic spaceships around the sun that we're seeing on a regular basis, while Ella connects the dots to why our sun is so perturbed, causing our present climate change crisis, and how we're living through the biblical end times prophecies unfold before our eyes. And I'm really looking forward to this. Ella is a biblical scholar, an ET experiencer, and longtime UFO researcher. She's a member of both MUFON Colorado and MUFON National, and is the author of a highly popular original six-book nonfiction series entitled Who's Who in the Cosmic Zoo, A Guide to ETs, Aliens, Exoplanets, and Space Controversies. So without any further ado, Ella LeBain, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Hi, thanks, James, for having me. It's good to be here.
Likewise, your information is so timely. In the recent past, I've had Pierre Sabbat come on here, talk about the etymology, the philology behind a lot of the words embedded and phrases and terms embedded in our languages, ancient to modern times, which conclusively prove that aliens are here, that a lot of the language and terms that we take for granted actually had origins with these non-human beings. And I've had Dr. Joseph Borel on here talk about the ancient interplanetary cosmic war. So you're a person right after my own heart. I actually had Dan Armstrong in here in the recent past talking about going over certain beliefs, certain sculptures that specifically talk about alien intervention, human sacrifice, the whole nine yards. So please tell us how you got started on your voyage of discovery. The floor is yours.
Well, thanks. First of all, I want to say, to thank you for your work, because that's how I found you, was through my research. And back in the 90s, I've been kind of at this since the early 90s. I used to teach classes in Florida, ETs, Aliens, or Angels, and I met up with a bunch of different ufologists, Michael Lindemann, in fact, one of them, and he handed me Carla Turner's book, The Masquerade of Angels. And one thing led to another, and I found you because you were part of that core group in California, Southern California, and then of course Evie, who's become my friend and therapist. And I came across your articles that you published on the reptilians, and I had reached out to you, if you remember, asked for permission to quote you and use a little bit more than fair use. And it's in my first book, fourth edition, which was just put out last August, under the chapter The Machiavellian Alien Agenda. So I just want to thank you for your work and contributions there, because Carla Turner's material really inspired me to get into the who's who in the cosmic zoo discernment. So That's what I'm, you know, there's an old Chinese saying, you know, you teach what you need to learn. And so that's been my journey. I had to learn discernment. I'm still learning it. So that's the purpose of my book series is to teach that, expose it, kind of stimulate people to look at both sides. And so I started out with seeing things the, you know, as I guess I should go back and tell you that I was raised Jewish, and they sent me to Israel when I was in high school. So I spent high school in Israel and at Sde Boker in the Negev Desert. And they sent me there to get an education, and I came back with Yeshua. So that's how I kind of got started on all of this, because I was 18 years old, and I was waiting on a visa to go to South Africa after my graduate. I had graduated in July of 79. And of course, it's, you know, middle of the summer there, dead heat in the desert. And I was held up for a month, waiting on a visa to go to South Africa with my then boyfriend. And I, was helping my, principal clean out her office, because we were the last English class. They closed it after us. I guess we broke the mold. And, and a book, she gave me a book, and it was called The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey. I'm sure you heard of it. And it turns out that book so happened to have been on David Ben Gurion's coffee table when he died. And Sde Boker is where he not only started his the kibbutz, which was a mile away, the field school, which is where I went, which was an arm, a department of the Ben Gurion University in Beersheba. He was buried at Sde Boker, so right where we went to school. So that's why it was there, because his house was there and everything. So I'm waiting on a visa for a month. I had nothing better to do than read and lay in the sun and hang out. And 3 o'clock in the afternoon, out of the sun, literally, broad daylight, bright light. I was wide awake, not under the influence of anything. This being just appeared right before me, literally came right out of the light in the desert, and he said, "I am the Messiah, follow me." And I was gobsmacked. I was 18 years old. What did I know? And I was like, okay. And then disappeared. And meanwhile, I'm reading this book, and it's all coming alive to me as to why I had to learn the Old Testament, the Torah, and my final exams were on it, on the prophets. So when I see, you know, the late great planet Earth, and he's connecting dots between the Old and the New Testaments, and how I just came away from with this understanding that he really, that Yeshua, Jesus, really is and was and has been all along the Jewish Messiah. So, of course, you know, they sent me to get an education. I come back with Jesus, and I was excommunicated from everyone, all my entire Jewish family, all my friends, even my boyfriend. That's the reason why we broke up. But I did get to South Africa, and I ended up spending 2 years there, working as a counselor to assisting missionaries through the Assemblies of God. And I went through three visas, and then when it was time for the fourth one to get approved, it was like the hand of God said, okay, no, they basically said, you have to go back to the States to reapply, and then you can come back. And it was really the intervention of the Lord saving me for what was about to come down. So when I was there, I was immersed in this spiritual revival. Okay. I had never seen, I mean, of course, what did I know? I mean, I was 18 years old and I'm just like new at all this. Signs, wonders, miracles. I was working in Zulu land on a place called KwaZulu-Bantu, and this 23-year-old African Zulu woman, she was very sick with kidney failure, kidney disease, and she died. And everyone was praying for her that she would come through, that she would heal, and she died. And they were getting ready to bury her and put, you know, do the final funeral rites and all of that. And she woke up and she came alive and she was completely healed as if nothing ever happened. And she told everyone she saw Jesus. Okay. And he basically told her she was going up this mountain and he was on the top of the mountain and she was going towards him. And he said, the reason that you can't come all the way right now is because of the chains on your ankles. And they were like, you know, like necklace chains, you know, like little thin chains. And he said, but I am forgiving you of everything, and I want you to go back and forgive your family because apparently she had a lot of resentments towards her family and, you know, all kinds of family dramas and stuff. And he said, I want you to go forgive your family and tell them about my forgiveness, and I'm going to give you your life back. And that's exactly what happened. And she came back and she was completely healed. So I, as an 18-year-old, was so impressed and so like wowed with all of this, and I thought, wow, you know, so all of this must be real. I mean, this is supernatural, not, you know, paranormal. And there's a difference between paranormal and supernatural, and we can get into that. So of course, that's what got me following, you know, to really kind of commit, and you know, and then after I got back to New York, when they sent me after 2 years, I expected to see the same kind of spiritual revival that I was involved in. I didn't even realize it was a spiritual revival until the contrast of New York, which was literally a spiritual graveyard. And I went searching from church to church to church, you know, are you there, Lord? Where are you? Where's the presence? Where's the spirit? And I was very disenchanted, and I got very, you know, like kind of suppressed and depressed, and so I ended up working for Jews for Jesus for a couple of years, kind of helping them. And they're not a church; they're an organization that focuses on Jewish evangelism. But they teach Christians, you know, Gentile Christians, how to evangelize. So I basically learned, you know, how to talk to people, what not to say, that kind of thing. But meanwhile, I was being bombarded with all these experiences with these gray aliens and blue lights coming through my walls in my fourth floor walk-up apartment in New York City. So that got me really curious about what is going on and why was God letting this happen to me? Okay. So, that is pretty much what started my search for the truth about what, you know, what was, that's when I woke up to the fact that there was a spiritual battle. And just because you can get saved and accept Christ and do work for him and works and all that kind of stuff doesn't mean that you're like delivered. Okay. So then that became, you know, my next kind of level to get to, which didn't happen until 2010. So that was like 35 years later, 35, 40 years later, when I kind of realized that, oh, you know, deliverance is just a whole nother level of walking with the Lord. And I had a near-death experience in February 7th of 2010. I saw Yeshua again. He took my hand. I mean, I recognized him immediately. I knew it was him. And he told, and I was at the time writing this book, about the aliens. You know, the who's who, the first one. And it was just all about, you know, like like listing, you know, every single, and I was collecting information from everybody since the 90s about who they were, who the alien presence was. And he basically said to me, you know, you're going to be okay. I'm going to help you. I'm going to heal you, but I want you to rewrite, because I got very disenchanted with Christians. I forgot to tell you that part. So I sort of fell away because of anti-Semitism. All right. So I was judged. I was maligned. I was, you know, not treated well in churches, but I never gave up my belief. And that he was real, because I saw him. So you can't like go back on that. It doesn't matter what's written. It's like it's experiential, you know? So, and then when I saw him again and he said, I want you to rewrite your book with me in it. Okay. So I did. And it's now turned into 7 books, actually, because I'm about to put book 6 out. And my editor just told me it's too big. You got to split it into 2 books. So now we're going to have a book 7, and that's going to be the final one of the series. So the Lord has basically shown me a lot of like the contrast, why I felt the way I did, why I went through what I went through. And I'm not alone. I'm not unique. I'm not that special. A lot of people have gone, I've met so many people who have gone through very similar experiences. So after my near-death experience, I sought deliverance, okay, because I realized that what led to it, what happened to me, what I was going through, the traumas that led to that. I actually had a heart attack, and it was caused by too much cortisol in my blood. So it wasn't, thank God, it wasn't the organs, it wasn't the heart. It was hormones that, like, when and it was because I wasn't sleeping. I mean, I literally went days without sleep. Okay, so that sort of like not, and it was adrenal exhaustion, which is something that I saw is what these reptilians do, is that they drain people. And that's the whole thing with the adrenochrome and the and adrenal. And I was completely flattened because they drained me completely, okay, to the point of death. All right, but because it wasn't like my time to go and all of those reasons why people get sent back. So I got a new, fresh start, I guess you can say. It took me 1.5 years to heal from what happened. And while I was in that healing phase, I sought deliverance. And I started to realize that there was more to following Christ than just a belief or an intellectual understanding of the Bible, which I had. But this was something deeper, which was this battle going on over my soul and over everyone else that I knew. And so there is Who's Who in the Cosmic Zoo. That's what this is about, is this real Star Wars, like you said at the beginning, the real Star Wars. And it's the truth is stranger than fiction. It's in the Bible, and it's been going on for millennia. So there's nothing new, and all this stuff and all this talk about the visitors and how we're being visited, that also perplexed me, because these beings have been here all along. They've been living and coexisting. The real coexist is them. And what I'm uncovering through religion, through my studies of religion, you know, is that they've been manipulating human beings through religious experiences, which is why there are so many people and there's so many cults and who think that oh, they've had contact with ET, or they, and even I have had to question my own experiences. Was it really Jesus? Prove it to me. And of course I went through, and he does say, test the spirits. You know, and one of the things that he says is to do, is how do you know who is who in which kingdom? Because there's basically two kingdoms. There's the kingdom of God, and then there's the draconian kingdom of Satan, darkness, you know, all of that. So, and here's the thing, it's not really fair, because the kingdom, the reptilians and the lizards and the draconian satanic kingdom of darkness counterfeits the kingdom of God. So that's what makes the game sort of interesting, because it's hard to tell them apart sometimes. So that's why we need discernment. So where do we get discernment from? We got to go to God, to the Holy Spirit, who gives you the gift of discernment. So this was something I didn't have, and I had to learn, I had to cultivate, and I had to ask for it, because he says, Jesus says, you have not because you ask not, in James 4:2, I think. So you have to ask for these things. People think it's just some things they think are automatic, and they're not. And this is where I got into this level of spiritual legal ground, which is detailed in my first book, Why Jerusalem, and all of that, and how, why the dark forces have this, they get legal rights to harass and attack people. And it was back in 1989, if you remember Bob Lazar, who came out of, Area 51. Well, he told my friend Michael Lindemann, who put it in his book, The Alien Presence, Six Viewpoints. And he also told George Knapp this, that the aliens look at us as containers. That's how they view us as, humans. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Because, I mean, it's like a thesaurus word, right? Containers, because the Bible calls us vessels, okay? So vessels, containers, same thing, right? So it really depends on, and C.S. Lewis said there's no neutral ground in the universe. You're either owned by God or countered by Satan. So even people who are atheists, who don't believe in anything, they're still being used as a container for something because they're just not aware of it. Okay. So how much so can the people who are religious, who think that they have met this one or that one or had a contact experience with this being, how can they be sure? This was has been my burning question, that they are who they think they are. So I went, so Jesus said, well, by their fruits you will know them. So these fruits have to do with the fruits of the spirit, which are characteristics, personality traits. And then, of course, there are personality traits, characteristics, fruits that belong to the reptilian, draconian, satanic kingdom of darkness. But they have the ability to counterfeit, it makes everybody confused sometimes. So this is the purpose of the book series, why I did this. It's been my journey to discern and analyze and learn and see, wait a second, because here you have this big craze. We're in what we call disclosure, but it's not like full disclosure yet. And there's a lot of reasons why our government, the American government, and even other governments in the world will not come clean with full disclosure, because they're for very good reasons, national security, and that they don't want rogue nations or enemy hostile nations to know what they know and get the technology that they have and use it against them. So these are all, reasonable reasons. However, when you piece it together, which is what I've done with the Bible prophecy, and this was something they told me, okay? So this marked me at age 18 when I basically gave my life to Christ through the Assemblies of God. And they all saw that I had all these books. I had astrology books, UFO books, Chariots of the Gods, all this stuff. And they said, you got to give all that up now. They said, have nothing to do. I'll never forget this. This is what started this journey for me. Have nothing to do with the UFO phenomenon, because when the rapture happens, the devil is going to lie to the rest of the world that the Christians were all abducted by aliens. And at 18 years old, I went, huh? And that started all of this for me. So what have I come to in terms of a conclusion? Well, they had a point. Let's just say that, because it's in the prophecy, all right? And Nobody knows, I don't claim to know, and no one is supposed to know when the Lord is to return, when the rapture is going to happen. Nobody knows. And anyone who says they think they know, or they use astrology or numerology or Jewish holidays, which is the nut-making that goes on in like Hebrew roots movements and all this, these cults that think they can predict with blood moons and all this kind of nonsense. The reason that the Lord doesn't, and he says nobody knows, not even the Son, not the angels in heaven, not even the Son, only the Father, because this is the one thing that has to do with this war, this battle, that God is going to have, the element of surprise. And if one of us knew about it, don't you think that the God of this world, who is Satan, is going to know about it, and he'll do something to like usurp it, like he's done in the past, right? I mean, there's a whole history in the Old Testament about how many times he tried to, destroy the bloodline that Jesus was supposed to be born in, and he does all kinds of stuff like that. So we're not supposed to know. But the point is that when it does happen, it will inevitably cause catastrophic disclosure, which is the very thing that our government is concerned, worried, and scared about. They don't want that to happen. And that's why, like, for instance, back in 2020, it actually started in 2015. So Chaim Eshed, who is the Israeli retired space chief, long career as the security chief and the space force of Israel, and he wanted to come out and tell people that they were dealing and working with the Galactic Federation. And they were told, no, you can't do that. Then again, 4 years, 5 years later, in November of 2020, he gave this interview to the Israeli newspaper, kind of equivalent to the New York Times here, which is called the Yedidot Ahronot, and he basically spilled the beans to them. He also wrote a book, which they actually published for him, which detailed all of his whistleblowing disclosures. Okay. And one of the things that he said that was really like caught everyone's attention, but not everyone, because remember 2020, everyone was under the pandemic. So when this came out and it surfaced on the news, people went, all right, whatever. What next? Right? And they didn't take it seriously. But he basically said that they were in working agreements with the Galactic Federation, Israel, and the United States, and that President Trump knew about it. Okay, well, this is like, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And this guy has more credibility than like anyone. I mean, he's like 88, he was 88 years old when this happened, which I find kind of interesting that a lot of these octogenarians, they want to spill the beans late in life, because he even said, what do I got to lose? Right? And it was like they want to leave something behind, like William Tompkins, same thing. MUFON did their whole symposium on his whistleblowing disclosures in 2017, the secret space program. And then, on that big eclipse, August of 2017, that's he died on that morning, natural causes. But the point is that I've been collecting what these whistleblowers are saying, because if it wasn't for the whistleblowers, we'd all be like mushrooms, you know what I mean? Kept in the dark and fed. You know what I mean? And thank God for the whistleblowers, because they know, as human beings, that we have the right to know some things about what's been going on. And as a researcher, I can understand and have respect for our government, the United States government, the Israeli government, even other governments of the world, who want to keep certain things secret for security purposes. Now, back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, they were always doing these culture tests, social tests to see where people were at. how they would handle this type, because they've known about this since World War II. Okay. And then, of course, everybody knows about Roswell, and that sort of overshadows all the other crashes that happened, which, by the way, Chaim Eshed details in his book. So he basically corroborated everything that David Grush said a year ago, July of 2023, to Congress when he talked about like the crash in Italy in 1933. Eshed put it in his book in detail, and in Russia, here in the United States, all over the planet, there's been crashes and retrievals, not only of the technology, but of the bodies. So one of the things that Eshed disclosed was there was a crash. I think it was in Siberia or somewhere up in Russia, and they found human bodies, okay, that were attached to some kind of oxygen apparatus. Okay, so now they're coming out with, could these beings be us in the future? And that's what the talk is in, the university, in this new Harvard University study, which I found very vindicating, because I published this in 2012, that the alien presence is here. They're inside the planet. They're under the ocean beds. They're in the mountains. They're underground. They're deep inside the earth. They've been living here for millennia. And that's why religions and mythologies have all these, stories of seeing these beings, calling them all kinds of things, fairies and elves and trolls. And I mean, even Jacques Vallée, who's like one of the leading ufologists and scientists, he even said that, that this has been happening for the longest time, and that he even said demonic activity is equivalent to people who have had alien experiences. So when you piece all this together, you get there's this battle, okay, going on. And and they're not all on the same side. They're not all on the same page. And one thing that I find, in the Christian, I call it the Christian fringe, because they write a lot of books about the fallen angels, and they know that, okay, the aliens, and they just say this blanket statement, all aliens are demons. And that bothers me, I gotta be honest with you, because that's not true. Okay. Yes, all demons are aliens, but not all aliens are demons. So I proved this through scripture. Okay. Because if you're gonna talk to Christians, you gotta talk the word of God. And the scripture talks about the creator God, the Lord, who actually created alien creatures to serve him, to serve his throne. And they're detailed and described in the book of Ezekiel. I mean, these beings with six different wings and beings with all these different eyes. I mean, okay, maybe those are spaceships, but they're living ships. And when we go and look to science fiction, for instance, so let me just back, sidestep here, just to insert this in, is that this is one of my monikers, is The Truth is Stranger Than Fiction, because back in the 50s, there was a think tank, the Majestic 12. They decided, okay, we're going to have to control the information. All right. So how are they going to control all the information and yet get people prepared? Because they knew, based on several different social tests, like War of the Worlds, the Orson Welles thing, that was one of them in the 30s. But there were other tests that happened, and they realized that people just were not ready for this. They had to be mentally, spiritually, culturally prepared. So they thought, okay, well, we'll just have to give these concepts and these pieces of truth to science fiction writers, screenwriters, directors, producers, so that this can be a vehicle to prepare the public for what we already know that they're preparing for when they started the secret space program, which was like the real Star Trek. And there's a whole story behind the interaction, the relationship between Gene Roddenberry and these two admirals. And he was fed this information about the future tech. So it became futuristic, not necessarily science fiction. Okay, more like future, because there's 68 different technologies that the original Star Trek showcased in the 60s that is now our reality. Okay,
Just
so
to
you
interject for a
could
second,
really,
also, Arthur C. Clarke was one of those people that were working as consultants with Gene Roddenberry. Clarke was a longtime CIA intelligence asset, and it was through Clarke, I believe, that Roddenberry was introduced to a contactee who'd had a number of experiences with human-looking aliens, and this contactee was the one that told Gene Roddenberry about this Galactic Federation, about these alliance or alliances with certain ET groups, right? And so that a lot of that became the basis for the Star Wars saga. But please continue.
Yes, I agree. That is very true. And Arthur C. Clarke said a lot of things that were true, and he knew what was going on. But the point is that people couldn't handle this. And also, let's not forget that famous meeting with Eisenhower and Nixon when they were offered technology that no one in No, none of your people would ever have to be sick again. Every injury could be healed instantly, kind of like that device that they use in Star Trek that goes over your body and it brings you back to life. And they offered it to them, and they said no, because they wanted them to put down their nuclear weapons. And that's what got their attention when the United States bombed Japan, because they woke up the inner beings inside the earth, and they went, whoa, okay, now they got that. They have that technology. We got to do something about it, because it's not, and people think it's not just they're the only ones on the planet. They're the top of the food chain. And that's not the truth. Unfortunately, we are not the top of the food chain. So these are, hard truths to swallow for a lot of people, especially if they've been, indoctrinated and raised in certain, cultures and religions and stuff like that. I take comfort in the fact that the Judeo-Christian faith has this information embedded in it. And that's how we know that this is old, this is ancient, this has been going on for a long time, and how we can also trust the promises and the prophecies of God concerning this alien presence, because the Lord has a lot to say about it. Okay? And unfortunately, due to anti-Semitism, and this is a big piece, okay, which is now up. I mean, it's grown on this planet in recent years back to levels of where it was during World War II. But where did it all begin? It started with the Church of Rome. It started with Rome. And this all dovetails into the end time prophecy of the revived Roman Empire. So the Roman Empire was, it people say that it fell due to Christianity, but it didn't exactly fall. It just kind of morphed, okay? Because the nations, and I found this to be really fascinating, that all these nations that they ruled over, like in the northern Horn of Africa and in the Middle East and in Turkey, all in Asia and all this, have now become Muslim nations. Okay, so I'm like, okay, where did this all begin? I mean, we know that Islam began around 750 AD. But it was facilitated. Now, this is something, I mean, I published this. This is in my second book. I prove this through history, through scriptures, through the Quran and the Bible and all of this, because the Quran is like almost like the Bible. It's almost like a plagiarized Bible, except with a twist and a spin on it. So who did that? And it made me question, okay, like Muhammad, first of all, there's no record that he was a writer. In fact, he was illiterate. He was from a warrior caste, which is, so I found research through history. This is just pure history. You can't make this stuff up, that the Church of Rome sent their monks, that Pope in the 700s wanted to take Jerusalem. Okay. So you say, why Jerusalem? They wanted Jerusalem for themselves. All right. And Jerusalem is one city on the face of planet Earth that has been fought over more and transferred power from one empire to another more than any other location on this planet. So I ask, why Jerusalem? What's so special about it? Well, go back. I went and found this information back in the ancient Sumerian text through Zachariah Sitchin, who his very last lecture right before he died was all about Jerusalem. And one of the things that he exposed and uncovered about Jerusalem was that it was an ancient space portal. I mean, this is what's in Sitchin's material. So I thought, okay, well, maybe that's why they're all fighting over Jerusalem, because there's some kind of opening there that takes you into another world, another planet. There's a lot of coming and going, which is why there's so many changes of the guard. Okay. The Roman Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the British even. And so anyway, back to the Church of Rome. So I found out that they went after Muhammad because he was a warrior caste family and wanted to groom him to take Jerusalem for Rome. So they did. They groomed him. That's where the Quran came out of. That's why the Quran is almost like identical to the Bible, because they were written by monks, but with a twist. That's how Islam got started. Okay, as a competing religion to Christianity, all right? And Muhammad did take Jerusalem, but he didn't give it to the Pope. So, and then of course, the rest is history. That's the Crusades began, and he wanted to keep it for himself. So, and this is where we're at now, okay? Because they're still fighting over Jerusalem. So when Obama, my first book, which was published in 2012, starts off with the first chapter, Why Jerusalem? Because during the Obama administration, which was something unprecedented to American Jews, okay? So there's a lot of Americans that live in Israel for different reasons, okay? And then they have babies, okay? Life happens, right? And so when babies are born, they get a birth certificate, and that birth certificate is supposed to say the date, the time, and the place of birth. Well, under the Obama administration, he wrote an executive order basically forbidding them to write on their birth certificate the place of birth would be Jerusalem, comma, Israel. If they were, of course, born in Jerusalem, they couldn't have the word, comma, Israel afterwards. Okay, so of course this created lots of lawsuits, and one thing, after another, and people were like, I mean, this is a world where everyone is fighting over their identity, right? Or at least their perceived identity. So here was like, oh, they wanted to have that they were born, but Obama wouldn't give them that because as far as he was concerned, Jerusalem didn't belong to Israel. Okay, so this is the Muslim perspective. This is the Palestinian, the Gaza, all of this stuff, which is ancient. Okay, so let me just say this for your listeners, just in case you haven't heard this. I'm sure you already know this, James, because we're friends on Facebook and you see my posts. The word Palestine was coined by the Romans. It was Latin Palestina, which was their word for the Philistines. The word Philistine comes out of the Bible, and the Philistines hung out their land, their peace, their turf was what we call today Gaza. The Gaza Strip was the land of the Philistines. So they were arch enemies to the ancient Israelites. So when Rome took over Israel, They wanted to basically stick it to the Jews and oppress them, and that's where the word came from. They called them Palestinians as a mockery. It was rooted in anti-Semitism. Okay, and that's where you have, that's why there's no real Palestinians, because they identify that now because that's what it's called now. But back in the past, they were Philistines, and they were giants. And everybody remembers the famous story in the Bible with David and Goliath. Goliath was a giant and he was a Philistine, and they all hung out in that Gaza Strip. So here we are, we've come full circle from thousands of years, and they're still fighting over that same piece of land and that portal and the people, who belongs to who's this, who's that, all of that. One thing that I have found to be a common denominator, like, how are we going to pull all this together? How are we going to heal all these divisions and rifts and battles? Only this is the job of the Messiah. He's the only one that is tasked and has the supernatural power to do that. And he's doing that through the agency of the Holy Spirit, which is why he said in the last days, your young men will dream, will see visions and dream dreams, and the Spirit will be poured out on everyone. Okay? So it's not about, like, your status in the temple or your status in the church. It's about how the Spirit is moving. And this is why today, okay, as we speak in 2024, I'm getting reports of hundreds of Muslims that in Gaza, the so-called Palestinians that are there fighting for their lives, having visions of Jesus, having visions of Christ, and coming over to see him as the Messiah. I mean, this is supernatural, okay? And he is the common denominator that brings all of us together, that can bridge the gap between the Jew and the Arab, the Jew and the Gentile, and all of us, okay? So it doesn't matter who you are, where you came from. We're all kind of a potpourri, on this planet by now, and by design. So I proved this in my fourth book. Like, where did all the lost tribes of Israel go? And I did all this research and found out that they went all over the place. There were two diasporas from Israel when the Jews got driven out of the land. And they were all over the place. They were in Europe, they were in Afghanistan, they were in Japan, they were in China, they were in Africa. And now, at the end times, they're all called back to the land of Israel, which is why Christian eschatologists, believe that the end times began when Israel became a state in 1948. So this is something that the United Nations has been trying to undo, okay, and that is the basis of World War III, which is where I believe we're already in. We've begun. So, and it's just, like, world wars, they don't have to go on for decades. They can be fought and done in 5, 7 years, right? So this began, when they attacked Israel on October 7th, and we all know this is not conspiracy, this is fact, it's out there, that Hamas is funded by Iran, Hezbollah are proxies of Iran, the Houthis, in Yemen, Daesh, ISIS even. I mean, ISIS kind of, like, dissipated into these other groups. It's all part of the same ball of wax, or the same 10 heads of the same dragon, which is jihad. Okay? And nobody wants to talk about that. Okay? Because, during the Obama administration here in America, it was suppressed. You couldn't even string the words together, radical Muslim terrorist. You couldn't do that. Okay. Even though that's what they even identified with themselves. And we all know, based on the current events and the situation in our world, that Islam is split into two parts, right? You've got your the secular ones, and the ones who are into jihad, who think that is the ultimate expression of their faith, is to kill the Jews, wipe Israel off the face of the earth, genocide the Jews, and like erase history. And that's not a conspiracy. That is their modus operandi. That is their plan. They chant it, they say it, they're right out there speaking it. So like, at what point do we like take them seriously? Okay. And this is the battle between these two kingdoms now, that it all seems to funnel and come down to Israel. All right. Which is where I believe what our government is trying to suppress by preventing catastrophic disclosure will inevitably happen as a result of these of this end time war, which the Bible says is going to be fought in the air for the whole world to see, which is, let's just call that a Star Wars type scenario.
Yes, and if you look at the Islamicization, I'm trying to pronounce it properly, of the planet, essentially, right? We're talking about a religion that was essentially created 750, 800 AD by a guy, if he even existed, Muhammad, but by a guy who, by his own admission in his writings in the Quran, is a pedophile. He married a 9-year-old girl named Aisha. I saw a video recently where a guy in Britain was talking about this. He was in a street corner and he was saying to a group of Muslims, it was like Muhammad married a 9-year-old Aisha. He was a pedophile, right? And he was assaulted basically by a bunch of not only Muslim men, but women too. And I've talked about this also, the problem of consanguinity, if that's how you pronounce it properly, where if you go back clear into ancient times, incest and sexual relations and offspring between close relatives is still to this day the norm in a lot of these Islamic countries. And because of that incessant interbreeding, and let's face it, folks, incest is not a matter of consensual sex. If a father wants to have sex with his daughter over there, or an uncle with his niece, it's not like, oh, niece, do you feel like, it's nothing like that. So the conception and the offspring that is begotten from these unions, if you want to call it that, is based on trauma to begin with, right? So you combine that, this incessant inbreeding, the concept of the jinn, of non-human spirits. A lot of these Islamic types are constantly hexing each other. That's another thing people don't realize. They're constantly sending curses at their cousins, at their friends, at their neighbors, at their business rivals. So the concept of supernatural spirits, enchantments, hexes, and curses is well embedded in their culture. And if you look at it from the standpoint of the Islamic jihadist conquest mentality, the way that they've been allowed to pour in to the West, where in their ideology, in their culture, where I've seen videos of Islamic women saying it's perfectly fine with us if Islamic men want to rape, European women, it's
That's
perfectly
awesome.
fine. It's perfectly fine. And also, we talked about the pedophilia aspect, the consanguinity, and how this is cultural, this is ethnic. Because if you look at Indonesia, which has the largest Muslim population in the world, you don't have these stories of the Indonesian Muslims going around doing all this. So they can be repressive and brutal towards the East Timorese and Papua New Guinea and places like that, because they do have a hardcore military junta, essentially, that's closely aligned with the CCP. But these stories of Indonesians going around the West and decapitating, mutilating, raping, and what have you, that you just don't hear that. So there's definitely a ethnic DNA aspect to it. And the DNA is a portal. It's a transceiver of information, a sender and receiver of information. So when you have this incessant consanguinity, brothers throughout the Muslim world, Pakistan, a classic example, so much incest, so much consanguinity going in there. Look what's going on in Dagestan, i.e. London, just so many grooming gangs, right? So you're talking about essentially an alien mentality where they have a predatory mentality and they see the West as this is ripe for the plucking. These little children, they're ours for the taking, is the mentality. And the way that it's allowed and the way that the natives in Britain and in Europe are suppressed when they say we're tired of these incessant rapes, we're tired of these murders, right? So what we're seeing is I see it as Sauron's army on the march, is how I see it, right? And it's getting to the point where it's either this is the kingdoms that you're talking about. You're either on one side or the other. There's not going to be any middle ground. And a quick point I want to make, and this has been a fascinating first segment, Ella. You brought up Trump and you brought up Ben Gurion earlier. Well, Ross Coulthart, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, but I think he's from Australia and he's done a lot of research and public talks
Attention.
about UFOs and UFO disclosure, et cetera. He said that, like you alluded to earlier, that Trump has been briefed up, there's no telling just how much he knows, but apparently, according to Ross Coulthart and his sources, Trump knows quite a lot. Now, I'm satisfied JFK got bumped off because he was going to come out with disclosure sooner than they wanted, and Majestic and Alan Dulles and others said, no, that's not going to fly.
I agree with that.
So they created all these cover stories, disenchanted Cuban anti-Castro, rebels, et cetera, the mafia, and they were all tied in. But that wasn't the underlying reason. And then, if you look at what happened, you brought up Reagan earlier. Chances are they were tapping Reagan's phone lines, they always do anyway, for presidents, and also his correspondence. And it became apparent to him that he had aliens on his mind. Because when he was on governor of California, he was on a plane. I think they were flying back to Sacramento, somewhere around Bakersfield, the UFO hotspot. I've seen stuff there. In the plane he was in, they saw a UFO. And then, Reagan was fascinated by the subject ever since then, at least. So what if, in our example, Reagan was going to try to do with JFK and come out with disclosure because they tried to bump him off in his first term, right? Didn't work. It didn't work. And
It's a
then
pattern.
it is a pattern. And then they did to him what they've done to other puppet leaders is they drugged him out in the second term, right? So he was old, he was kind of doddering old man and failing health. George Bush Senior actually was running the show all that time. Point being is that in his second term, no less than five times publicly he mentioned the possibility of alien invasions. He brought it up with Mikhail Gorbachev. Okay, so the SDI comes into play also, and we're going to do a deep dive in this in the second segment, among in any other direction you want to go, Ella, is you get the wheels going in my mind, because under Reagan and Edward Teller, especially out of Lawrence Livermore Lab, they really kickstarted the SDI program. Not many people realize it, but in what amounts to SDI research in Great Britain, with Marconi Corporation, which is involved in a lot of deep black, spooky, weird science stuff. They've had dozens of their scientists, technicians, and engineers die, disappear, or suicided. Dozens, right? They're directly related to SDI research. What Reagan had in mind was creating an SDI, which predated Trump's idea of a space force by decades. What if SDI was not so much geared up towards the Soviets, but to this alien threat, which Reagan was alluding to over and over? And then, and then second, by the time midway through his second administration, he was not only a lame duck, but similar to what Dr. Morrell did to Hitler, just drugging him out all the time. I mean, he was falling asleep in the meetings and what have you. And we saw less and less of him in the public. It's similar to with Brezhnev and, just doing a disappearing act, right? So anyhow,
Right.
we've reached the end of a fascinating first segment with Ella LeBain. Ella, could you let our viewers and listeners know how they can contact you and how to find your work?
Yes, thank you. I'm at who's who in the cosmiczoo.com, and all my books are on Amazon, pretty much worldwide channels in Australia as well, Amazon Australia. So I paperback, Kindle, and if you need the PDF for audio purposes, you can get it through my website. And I'm on
Wonderful. Yeah,
Facebook.
and you can find both of us there actually.
Yes,
And
yes.
to our dear viewers and listeners out there, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.